If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Wednesday, March the 13th, and you're listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Hoover Institution's Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow. Joining me in studio today here in Hoover's D.C. office, just a short stroll away from the White House, is Dr. Timothy Kane, the Hoover Institution's J.P. Conte Fellow in Immigration Studies. I'm also going to say something I rarely say about someone, and Tim is not only my friend, but I actually would have voted for him last year. I lived in Ohio. Tim has been on the podcast before, and if you follow the podcast, you know that Tim ran for Congress last year, and I think in retrospect, you may have dodged a bullet, Tim.
I think about that often, but yeah, I've put it out of my mind, actually, so there's a painful memory, but no, it's bizarre to see how much inaction gets done, and I'm sure it's very frustrating for newly elected high-energy people like my would-have-been colleague AOC, because they're just not getting done the things they want to get done.
Exactly. Well, we're going to talk today about something which is in your wheelhouse, and that's immigration, specifically a poll that you did for the Hoover Institution. You did that poll with our Hoover colleague, Doug Rivers, who has been on this podcast frequently times. And Doug is not just a Hoover senior fellow and a Stanford political scientist, but he's a chief scientist at YouGov LLC, and he is a pollster extraordinaire. I've done polls with Doug, Tim, on elections. And that's straightforward stuff. You know, there's an election coming up in November. Who's going to win? What do voters think? But you did one on immigration, and this is a big topic. It's not unlike sticking one's head in a fire hydrant because there's a lot to do. What were you after when you commissioned the poll? What was the purpose of doing it?
So, yeah, and you may remember Doug and I did a big poll with Dave Brady in the summer of 2017. This one wasn't as big a poll, but I wanted to ask one particular question. So Doug inserted it into a regular YouGov poll, just a one-off, what seems like what I call a screamingly obvious compromise. You know, and I've talked to I guess, mainstream Americans. I've talked to our fellow policy experts and former government officials at Hoover. Everybody seems to understand that there's this obvious trade that the president could make with Congress or Congress could make with the president, and that is, well, the president wants $5.7 billion to finish the wall. The Congress, at least the Democrats, have made a big priority about taking care of the Dreamers.
Right.
Even though plenty of Republicans support that, that's a huge priority for them. These, let's say, 800,000 people who were brought to the U.S. illegally as children. So many of them aren't children now. Nonetheless, why not put those two together and and compromise?
Right.
And that's what I wanted to ask in the poll. Did Americans agree?
So here's the question. I'll read it to you. It's a very well-worded question because when you get into immigration, there are a lot of tricky words one can throw in there. You can throw in the scarlet letter A, for example.
Right.
Talk about amnesty.
We'll get back to that.
You could talk about the border wall. You could not call it a wall. You could call it a structure. You could not put a dollar number. In other words, there are a lot of ways you can fudge the question, but here's what you said. Quote, would you support legislation with $5.7 billion for a U.S.-Mexico border wall paired with permanent legal status for aliens covered by President Obama's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival program? That's the question, plain and forward.
Absolutely. Right. And you point out it doesn't talk about citizenship.
Right.
It's a permanent legal status.
Right.
So that when you start talking about citizenship,
right,
and this is what we found in that earlier poll, a lot of people think that's amnesty.
Right.
Now, it's a work legal status type of situation. That's not amnesty. So we knew we were avoiding that trigger for some conservatives.
Right.
And so I expected, Bill, that we would get what I call the screamingly obvious consensus. 80% of Americans would say, yes, absolutely do that. And that's the op-ed that I was going to write.
Right.
Well, that's not the result. As you know, that's not what we found.
Oh, you waited for the results before you wrote
that. No, I didn't.
What a novel approach.
I had to rewrite the op-ed. That was really frustrating.
Okay, well, let's talk about the numbers because the lead in your op-ed is that there was a surprise. The surprise was what Republican voters said and what Trump voters in particular said.
Right. So we found that by a 2-to-1 margin, Republican voters favor this wall for Dreamers legal status compromise. The surprise wasn't that the Trump base was different than their typical Republican. It's the Trump base was even more supportive of this. More than 2-1. I'd call it about a 2.5-1 margin. Base voters like this deal. The second surprise, the big gotcha, was that Democrats didn't like the deal. Because I'll tell you what, and that got me scratching my head. 3 months ago they did. There was a similar question asked. It was actually more of the amnesty that we talked about earlier. Would you grant amnesty to these kids, give them a pathway to citizenship for a wall? Democrats did like that. So why the change? Well, we found out it wasn't because of this issue of citizenship. It's just because Nancy Pelosi called the wall immoral and has really hardened the positions of Democrats against letting the president get his wall.
Interesting. I note in the question that the words Donald Trump were not part of the question.
They weren't, huh? No, right. I guess not.
President Trump is not in there. Donald Trump is not in there. And I wonder if you had put Trump in that question, if two things would have happened. Democrats would have further gone kablooey and further not like the idea because they would have seen the word Trump. On the other hand, Trump supporters might have liked the idea more, thinking that, well, the president's name is attached to this, so all the Trump voters are therefore, as he goes, I go.
And I honestly don't have the wording. I have the op-ed in front of me.
Right.
We did try to make a distinction, but I think in an earlier question it had said Trump's wall. So I can't promise you that that wasn't in their mindset.
Right.
But that, again, almost exact wording from a December 2018 poll by a group called Harris X. It was published by American Barometer. That one found Democrats – what is it, 56% supported that the deal.
Right.
And in ours, it dropped down to about 25%. So why the collapse? And it's pretty clear. I've heard so many people say the wall is a big symbol for the base voters. Well, it's a big symbol for all voters.
Right.
But it's become more of a trigger of opposition for Democrats. And I don't think either – having – either set of voters be in the uncompromising camp is disturbing. Politicians can be there, but the voting public usually wants to find compromise. We found that again and again. Suddenly, Democrats don't want to compromise. That's a real problem.
That's interesting. But the Trump voter is interested in a deal because the Trump voter from this poll suggests the Trump voter wants to see progress.
Yeah. And
that's the conventional – that's what's interesting because the conventional wisdom is that we have two sides and each one's dug in. Democrats, no way the Democrats will go for a wall, but there's no way that Trump voters will compromise because of, again, because of that word amnesty.
Yep. We've got to, if this podcast does anything, it will emphasize that point. The Trump base wants compromise.
Right.
Didn't expect it, was happy to see that.
Okay, so now let's talk about whether or not compromise is possible on Capitol Hill because Congressman Kaine is not on the Hill. Congressman Kaine would have encountered a messy situation in the House because the House is under new management in 2019. Yeah. It's a Democratic House. It's still Republican Senate and still Republican in the White House. So divided Congress and a president, how do they get something done in immigration? Do you think there's any window possible for this in the next election or resist? Is this for 2021 and beyond?
It shouldn't be. There's a new Congress. You'd like to think they would want to get things accomplished unless Nancy Pelosi's Congress is really going to be focused on impeachment. She says she doesn't want to do that. Trying to embarrass the president or just marking off territory for the 2020 election. To me, it's very clear. You could even drop the wall. Just legalize Dreamers. Take what President Obama had in place with through executive action, DACA, and make it legislation. There's no pathway to citizenship there. It's a 3-year renewable right to be in the United States, to work, to go to school, whatever. Make that legislation. Because when you take citizenship out of it and you take welfare benefits and voting rights out of it, those are all the hot button controversial things. And it turns out that's not what many people that are categorized as illegal really want.
Right.
They want to come out of the shadows. They want to have the threat of being arrested and deported taken away, the right to work, take care of their families, not get citizenship. If Nancy Pelosi's serious, she would put forward a legislation that mirrored DACA. And I think if they're not going to do that, subtle advice to the White House is you guys propose it. And have her say why they're not going to bring Dreamers out of the shadows. Unfortunately, I don't think either side's listening to me right now, Bill. But maybe with this podcast, we'll turn that around.
There you go. This sounds like a situation that screams for a visit to Andrews Air Force Base. Conservatives revile Bush 41 for doing the deal on taxes back in 1991. Going to Andrews Air Force Base, meeting with members of Congress, and doing a deal on taxes. And Bush 41's heart was in the right place. We can have our colleague Mike Boskin on to talk about the tax deal and so forth. It's a complicated topic, if you will. But it strikes me as something like that for this reason. You're going to have to find a way to work on immigration, Tim, and get away from the peanut gallery.
Yeah.
Because the moment that Donald Trump says, I'm open to a deal on immigration, and Nancy Pelosi says, I'm open to a deal on immigration, they both get blasted from their respected corners. Mm-hmm. And one corner is Fox News, and the other corner is MSNBC.
Mm-hmm.
MSNBC will have a fit because of the wall, and Fox News will have a fit because, again, the specter of amnesty. So it's a question of how, in this very public time of social media and 24/7 cable news, Congress can get together and do something kind of on the down low.
Well, I would dispute your characterization in of Fox News, at least. But I take your point. I just say, I call that the Ann Coulter, Michelle Malkin wing. And they say...
I throw Laura Ingraham into that wing,
too. Fair enough. So yeah. there are definitely right. some hosts. Now, I think Sean Hannity, if the president were to reach out and find a way to get a compromise, he would celebrate it, right? Big mm-hmm. victory by the president. That's right. What Sean Hannity is going to do. And I don't think Sean's wrong on that. The Ann Coulters and the Michelle Malkins... keep saying they speak on behalf of the base and the base doesn't want compromise. I'll be honest, that's why I wrote this article.
Right.
You get all these knuckleheads that say they speak for the conservatives. They don't. They speak for their own rabid right-wing vision. Mm-hmm. And I consider myself right-wing. I'm a conservative guy.
Right.
But that rabid, the base will only take an extreme our way or the highway. You've got to, you know, no compromise with the other side. And they're wrong. That's right. not what the base thinks. It's not what Midwestern conservative voters think. And I think there are people in the White House that are telling the president, well, your base wants this. So I want this op-ed that I wrote to be a counterweight to some of those people inside the administration that are trying to get the president back to his instincts, which are not mean towards immigrants.
Right.
So I don't know. I hope we'll be successful. But we need to get a wedge in and get those get the extremists to lose some credibility.
Right. So this is interesting. So it sounds like if Trump actually wanted to do a deal, he's got to massage it along. And the first place to massage, he's going to have to talk to Hannity. He's going to have to bring Laura Ingraham in and talk to her about this too. And he's probably going to have to talk to Rush Limbaugh about this just to kind of get the chattering class on board with this. And maybe there'll be malleable to it if Trump can sweet talk him enough. Because, you know, one of the calculations here, at the end of the day, they're wed to Donald Trump, and I think Ann Coulter is seeing the situation right now. You can think the president's abandoned you, but you have no alternative. Your alternative is 12 Democrats running for president. You don't want any of them in office, so the president's still going to be your guy at the end of the day. So maybe that's the Trump beginning here. He has to talk to the people who, you know, the commentators who go on TV, go on radio, and represent the base, to talk to them about what is best, in fact, for the base.
Right. Well, yeah, first order of business is what's best for the nation.
Right.
This aligns, though, with what's best for Trump's reelection.
Right.
And I think there are some people that are doing what's best for their book tours and what's best for their own careers, and they're advising the president poorly to be uncompromising. He had a deal, you may remember, it was called the Cheeseburger Summit. So this is a year ago, before the last government shutdown. And Chuck Schumer had agreed to $25 billion for the wall.
Right.
Not $5 billion, $25 billion.
Right.
They had a handshake. Trump agreed to it. This was an exchange for, you know, regularizing Dreamers, maybe giving them pathway to citizenship. Mm-hmm. And Schumer left. And I think by that evening, the White House had walked it back. So whoever got to the president told him, your base is going to lose their mind. They passed up a sweet deal and served the president very poorly. If he's seen by the independent voters of Ohio, at least, as a guy who compromises and gets things done and does deals, as he's supposed to be famous for, he gets reelected. If he's seen as a guy who's mean towards immigrants and an extremist and beholden to the Ann Coulters, then I there's no way he gets reelected. And I hope he wakes up and realizes that.
Is it as simple as saying Stephen Miller is the problem here?
From what I've read, I've never met Stephen Miller, and I don't like to characterize people.
Stephen Miller, for background purposes,
yeah.
is President Trump's aide. He came to Trump from Jeff Sessions' office in the Senate. He writes speeches for Trump.
And known as the immigration czar.
Yeah,
right?
And hawkish on illegal immigration may be an understatement in terms of views. So the conventional wisdom is that if Trump has any kind of deal instincts about immigration, that there is Stephen Miller saying, don't do this.
Yeah. Yeah, and if that characterization's right, I don't have any privy knowledge of the inner workings of the White House. But let's use Stephen Miller as code for the person advising the president to not compromise. he's serving the president badly.
Right. I wonder where the first daughter is on illegal immigration.
Yeah, I would think, she, you know, things I've read, statements from her.
She's supposedly always the moderating force.
Right, yeah. that she is actually a proponent of a compromise. I think Jared Kushner also. But maybe they're getting some more responsibility and we'll see some action. But you got to move quickly on these things early, sure, in a congressional year,
right,
not in a presidential election year. So 2019 is their time to get this done.
What did you talk about in regards to immigration reform when you ran for Congress? Because you're running back in Heartland, USA. You're running in, mm-hmm, Ohio, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've always thought it was pretty easy to say I'm for robust legal immigration and zero illegal immigration. And,
right,
you know, defy anybody to disagree with that. And there are people who will say, well, I don't know, aren't they hurting our culture? And, you know, you talk to people and say, well, where did your ancestors come from?
Mm-hmm.
Germany or Ireland? I mean, they were considered the, you know, the outsiders. And by the way, not considered white at the time,
right?
Right? Certainly the Catholics weren't. So we all had roots and being outsiders and assimilated. And America's been great at that.
Mm-hmm.
And we did some polling too, Bill, in the political campaign. Being a pro-immigrant Republican, there were some people that didn't like that in the primary, but more, mm-hmm, people did like it.
Right.
Being avowedly pro-immigrant, as long as it's legal immigration.
Okay, so if we've established from the data in your poll that that the thought that the Trump base is opposed to a deal is a myth.
Right.
What other myths have you encountered regarding legal immigration?
I don't know if it's a myth I've encountered in polling, but I think it's fascinating that we've heard this number 11 million. There are 11 million illegal immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
I think it feels like Kennedy and Johnson were debating about 11 million. But for sure, in the last 20 years, that number's been a staple of the political conversation, and
right,
because it's actually a real number. The peak might have been 12 million illegal immigrants, and recent estimates based on census data are it's probably 10. So we've seen an out-migration, certainly of Mexican immigrants, legal and illegal, who are going back to Mexico because, mm-hmm, Mexico's economy is booming and growing. The concern now is immigrants from the triangle countries, Honduras and El Salvador. So I think that's been a real shift. People still think we've got a huge influx of Mexicans. Well, the immigration picture is a lot more diverse. People from India, from China, from Southeast Asia, still huge numbers from Africa and Europe. It's not that big. But I'm going to mention 11 million one more time just because it's dwarfed by a much bigger number. Americans don't seem to have any realization. 181 million visitors. Not migrants. We have 181 million tourists, business travelers, students, and guest workers, yes, who come here legally every year. We're an open society, not an illegal society. And you want to make sure you have an open, legal transit program for people to come here, spend money here, help us grow our companies, help work in our farms and fields.
Mm-hmm.
And we're already there. It's not a matter of making an open society. We're an open and the richest society in the world. That's one that the myth that we're collapsing and our economy's falling apart, we need to blame foreigners. That's the myth that sort of never dies.
And what about the economics? Is there an economic myth? Did you, when you're out campaigning, did people plain and simple think that it was a net drain or a net gain on the economy?
I've actually encountered, and this is more research than polling. So, mm-hmm, we published a paper, a working paper, a lot of math, at the Hoover website, studying the economic impact of immigrants, and found that they are a huge plus for GDP, for GDP growth.
Mm-hmm.
The states that have more immigrants grow faster. They create more jobs. But when you look, when you dig into the details, it's not all positive. There's a short-term negative effect on what you might call worker displacement. So if you have 10 immigrants come into a town, you might have a net loss of one job. Over a short term. In the long term, though, they're adding to the economy, they're helping grow the economy, and that job gets replaced. So there's a slight displacement effect,
mm-hmm,
but I think it's dwarfed by the positive numbers. And that again, that's real research. Politically, when I've talked to people about it, they don't really worry about the economic impact. They worry about crime. They worry about welfare abuse. And I think those are legitimate worries. I think those are things that the Congress needs. That's why I think amnesty does still have saliency with the body politic.
Why did this crash and burn the last time when the gang got together?
Come on.
No, I know it's a long topic. I know it's a complicated topic, but I mention this because we're talking about process here. If Trump wanted to do a deal, there are a couple ways to do the deal. One is he tries to get Schumer and Pelosi in the room with the Republican leaders, and they just sort of do it as the elders. The other is you throw it in Congress and let the process drive it. And it sounds to me, Tim, like if you let the process drive it, that it's, you know, it's not paralysis by analysis. It's paralysis by something else. But it ain't going
to
happen.
The political system always wants to throw one more pet issue into a big compromise bill, and it gets so big it never passes. Compromise is the dirty word here.
Right.
So,
so the last time this was brought up, though, this is back in the last decade.
Yep. Right?
Yep. Before the 2008 election.
There was the George Bush bill effort to do comprehensive reform. There was the gang. Mm-hmm. I think it was the Gang of Eight that they got Marco Rubio involved with under Obama's presidency. Those failed. Right. The comprehensive stuff's always going to fail. And it goes back to advice I got when I was 6 years old. My mom looked at me and said, Tim, you can't eat a hamburger in one bite.
Yeah.
You know? So, you know, Congress needs to learn that lesson that my mom knew. You guys, immigration's too big. It covers students. It covers guest workers who aren't going to be really immigrants. They're just guest workers in the ag sector. Mm-hmm. It covers legal and illegal. It covers border security. It covers terrorism. You can't put it all in one bill.
Right. So if you don't do the omnibus HR 1 or SB 1, you do it bit by bit.
Let's
put you back into Congress now.
Yeah.
So let's put you as a heady young freshman. Let's put you in charge of the process. So you're going to do this by pieces, not in mass. So tell me, how many pieces to the puzzle, Tim, and what order would you do the pieces? Keeping in mind that it's maybe, do you do the toughest vote first? You save the toughest vote for last? How do you drive it?
Do the easy votes first. There's a meeting I had, private meeting, with Congressman Yoho. He's a member of the Freedom Caucus. Great guy from Florida. He has an idea to do an ag-only bill.
So it's guest workers.
And it's not even – right. It's not immigrants. It's guest workers to make it easier to get, I think, just H-2A visa workers into the U.S.
Right.
The farms need this. It's a bipartisan issue. Everybody knows this would pass with flying colors. If you could just get leadership to agree – not to try to do everything in a comprehensive
guest workers
bill.
Was part of IRCA back in the 1980s,
yeah,
right? I worked for a California governor who was a senator at the time, Pete Wilson.
Right.
So he was involved because of farm workers. Okay, so you do ag first.
That's his idea. I think it's a great one. I would, if it were Congress McCain, I would do that staple a green card to an engineering degree. Any foreign student that comes here and gets a computer science degree and then wants to go work for Microsoft or Google – and the alternative is they're going to go work for the People's Army of China. I mean, come on. Get them on our side. And, you know, they're going to have kids here, and they're going to want to stay, and they're going to want to be part of the U.S. society. We're in a national security rivalry with China. And the fact that any of their scientists would want to live here, and our first response is, no, the law says get out. That seems to be an easy bipartisan solution. Again, you don't find disagreement on it.
Mm-hmm.
What you find is, well, we need to keep that as a sweetener for the harder things we need to do in comprehensive. And that's not true. For 15 years, they've been saying it. What they really need to do on Capitol Hill is get a working coalition together on the simple things, and you build on that to the bigger things.
Okay, that's two measures. What about a third measure?
Oh, come on. I'm exhausted, Bill. I don't know. I think you could probably get border security done then.
Okay.
You could say, yeah, part of it's going to be for the wall, but part of it's going to be for more humane processing and you know, beds and all that sort of thing.
So you're probably not going to call it a wall. You're going to call it a border structure.
Border
right?
security and stopping sexual trafficking, for God's sakes, mm-hmm. which is a huge and a real problem that's created because Americans, I should say political leaders, have set up an incentive system for people to use coyotes to bring their children in. I mean, my God, let's change the incentive structure.
You're going to use the word humanitarian.
Absolutely.
Okay, so talk about the humanitarian.
Humanitarian and security bill. That'd be number three.
Okay. We haven't talked about the people already here, the 11 million, 14 million, whatever the number is. So now we've got to talk about pathway, legalization, status. So where does that fit in?
Yeah, I think you could do what I call it is sort of a just clean DACA vote.
Mm-hmm.
Let's make DACA a piece of legislation. I think you'd find a pretty big majority, and you'd make a lot of folks angry on the two sides that deserve to be angry, but you'd get 60-70% of congressmen to vote for it. And that would it wouldn't create a pathway to citizenship, but it would allow people to be here, to live here, and to participate in the citizenship programs that already exist.
Mm-hmm.
So they could still apply for green cards as part of the regular pool. It just would say there's not a special program for somebody who's broken the law, which as you can imagine, that is what it is, and it creates some perverse incentives.
Right. Now let's have our AOC a moment, our obligatory AOC, your fellow freshman colleague in Congress, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and we're going to make her head explode because we're going to have to deal with ICE.
Oh, yeah.
Immigration Customs Enforcement, that goes into this as well. Are you going to water down ICE, or are you going to beef up ICE, or keep things the way they are?
I don't think there's a serious Democrat who said...
she wants to get rid of it, right?
She said that.
I know, that's her rhetoric, but she...
And then what? Well, right. You have to have some sort of enforcement system. So it's very empty politics. And
right.
There are a lot of serious Democrats who know, even if they've talked about getting rid of ICE, we'd have to reinstitute the program under Border Patrol and Unified and Streamline or whatever.
Right.
And there's something to be said. When I've talked to Border Patrol agents, they've got frustration that, in fact, they're more processing agents than they are patrol agents. Because if they catch someone and that person says asylum, well, they immediately just hand them over to ICE. We don't empower our Border Patrol agents with any sense of judgment. And I think that's wrong. I think they should be able to tell somebody, no, you can't. You literally can't come across the wall here. I'm not going to process you into custody,
right.
Or to make a judgment, make a summary judgment. So yeah, there are things I would do to streamline and de-bureaucratize the system, but literally getting rid of ICE, I don't think it's a serious political.
Right.
It's a political soundbite. It's not a legislative issue.
Right. And then how would you orient the federal government vis-a-vis cities and states that have sanctuary status?
I think sanctuary status is a bad play politically, long term. I think sanctuary cities are unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been, I think, a little hard line on, I'm not very sympathetic with some of the towns and states. And I think California is one of those states that considers itself a sanctuary
state now, yes.
Other than that general statement, I wouldn't want to get too into the nuances. Just saying that you can defy federal law.
Mm-hmm.
I think South Carolina did that in the late 1850s, early 1860s. Didn't work.
No, I don't think it worked out too well for the South, did it?
No.
Let me run an idea by you, Tim, and you tell me if you think I'm nuts or not. Or go ahead and tell me in advance that you think I'm nuts. But it's this. Absent for this conversation are governors.
Hmm.
Governors who have to deal with immigration firsthand because they run states and their states have budgets and part of their budget goes to illegal immigration matters such as education, such as health care, such as incarceration. And governors are pretty quiet in this. Well, I take that back. Gavin Newsom, California, is very loud in this, but you hear governors talking about a fix so much that is angry at Donald Trump. Here is my crazy notion. There are four governors in particular who stand out to me, Tim. They're the governors of California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. So the first thing they obviously have in common is what? They're the border with Mexico.
Border states, yeah.
Secondly, Tim, they belong to an organization called the Border Governors Conference. Every year, those governors get together with their counterparts from six Mexican states, Baja California, Sonora, Chihuahua, Coahuila, Nuevo León, and Tamaulipas. And they get together and they talk about mutual issues. Why not those four governors who, by the way, are two Democrats, Gavin Newsom, California, Michelle Lujan Grisham from New Mexico, plus Doug Ducey, Arizona, and Greg Abbott, Texas. So it's bipartisan. Why can't those four men and women get together, Tim, and come up with a plan to send the Congress?
I like that. I think I ran across an idea here in the policy think tank community that I thought that blew my mind. I hadn't thought of before. And it's been in the back of my mind that it might be smart to federalize in the sense of empower the states, federalize your immigration, work visa programs, because right now they're very bureaucratic, very centrally controlled. Well, why don't we have states issue as many? Like, for example, H-2A visas are theoretically uncapped. You can bring in an infinite amount of agriculture workers, but it's a big bureaucracy to just get one processed. Why don't we just say no more bureaucracy, but if Texas farms want to bring in 2 million guest workers this year, that's up to the Texas governor. So let each state set their own guest worker quotas and manage the program. You'd want to make sure these people are all part of E-Verify.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that'd be a really neat piece of legislation that would empower the states to authorize guest workers.
Right.
Not really legal citizenship, just guest worker programs, student programs, And if the numbers were too high and they had to have that fight in their state about are they stealing jobs, then let it be handled in the state and handled it at that level where people are closer to the issue and know the benefits and the costs. Yeah, that's brilliant.
Yeah,
I'm going to credit you with that one, Bill.
Well, thank you. In the 90s, governors got together and they filed lawsuits against the federal government, and they demanded action from the federal government. And there's a bipartisan mix here. So it was Wilson in California. I think Lawton Charles was a Democratic governor of Florida at the time. Governor of Texas was, I don't know if Ann Richards was involved or not. I think New York might have been involved in the action at some point. Illinois is an interesting hodgepodge, and these were states, some with very serious immigration problems, not so much. But they were looking for money and relief from Washington and tried to get the issue on the radar. You don't have the challenge of getting it on Congress radar. I'll tell you a very funny story here. Pete Wilson went, as governor of California, went back to Washington in the, about 93, I think, to looking at getting money from the federal government to deal with his deficit. And he went to Robert Byrd, the late Bob Byrd from West Virginia, running the Appropriations Committee. And they'd been colleagues in the Senate, so it was collegial, and they talked, and he said, well, you know, Senator, with all due respect, you know, we've got a problem here, and just, you know, the federal government's not controlling the border, and it's coming in, and it's taking about $3 billion out of my $40 billion budget each year, and this is a serious business. I need Washington's help. As he told me the story, he said, Byrd kind of sat back and kind of thought about it, looked at him, and he goes, Pete, that's not a West Virginia problem. Out he went without any money because it didn't apply to West Virginia. But, Tim, here we are 25 years after that meeting, though, and you go to state in America, and it's very interesting. I have family in South Carolina. You go into Charleston around Thanksgiving or Christmas, and there's always the sound of hammers and nails hitting wood, and it's construction. People are speaking in Spanish. I don't want to stereotype or typicalize, but there are probably some illegal immigrants working in Charleston, finding work. This is what people do when they come across the border. They seek opportunity, and if opportunity takes you to the Sun Belt, off you go. So it's no longer a handful of states issue. It's a much broader national issue. But it'd be refreshing to see the governors, rather than 25 years ago looking for money, actually 25 years later offering a solution. But here's the question, Tim. If the governors wanted to offer a solution, who would be their champions in Congress? Who would they go to? Who in Congress, having seen what happened to Marco Rubio when he got involved in this, who in Congress, if they have any kind of aspirations for higher office, is going to stick their neck out and want to champion this?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's hard to find, when you talk about a creative solution like that, it's hard to find a champion, just because on immigration, it's been hijacked as a national issue. It's very tribal, symbolic.
Right.
And you're talking about a nuanced federal approach that's brilliant. And that's just not how D.C. politics works, unfortunately. But when you tell the story, it makes me laugh to think how Americans – can be told what a problem it is to have people want to come to this country and work and build. Construction, you mentioned, right?
Right.
I just can't imagine telling ancient Romans, yeah, your big problem was all these Greeks and Germans and Brits that wanted to come into the Roman Empire and work. No, that is never a problem. And I think we're going to realize that in our lifetimes because the demographics are changing. We live in a world where the number of children per woman has dropped in every country from an average of about 7 children per woman back in, say, 1960 in every Latin American country down to about 2, and in the high case, 3 children per woman. So the it's a supply and demand issue, and the supply of migrants is actually going to be drying up, and is drying up right now. And those economies, by the way, because of the shifting demographics, they're intertwined. Those economies are actually growing. Mexico's growing really quickly. We're going to very quickly have an immigration crisis, which is a shortage of workers, and you're going to have, we're already hear it on farms, but you'll have people screaming about construction costs are going up and grocery costs are going up. Those are labor-intensive areas, and we're gonna want more Americans, let alone the national security side of it. But you know, solutions, Bill. I think we've got to crack the tribalism first, and then we can get to very interesting state-based work programs that make a ton of sense. But you know, you, me, and all the listeners can get that.
Right.
But you get to the voting booth, and you get to I don't know, Trump's bully pulpit, and it's all focused on the wall and invaders and language that isn't helpful.
Tim, we could easily map out a scenario if Trump were not reelected in 2020. We can map out a scenario in which there's a Democrat in the White House in 2021, half of Congress. Let's say Congress stays the same after the 2020 election. The Senate doesn't flip. So Republicans hold the Senate and the Democrats hold on to the House. So now a Democratic presidential game, what Trump has right now, which is a divided Congress. So good luck getting immigration through that process. So a Democratic president's going to do what? What did Barack Obama say? Got a pen, I got a phone.
Yeah.
So a Democratic president might take pen in hand and do something on immigration. What could Donald Trump do on immigration in the way of executive orders? He has a phone, he has a pen.
Yeah.
So what could he do right now? What could he write? What could he issue? It might drive some Republicans crazy because they bashed Obama for doing it. But if Trump really wanted to move on the matter, what could he do with his own executive powers?
Well, the president's done a lot. And I wrote a piece for Eureka, you know, your fine publication a year ago, pointing out all the executive actions that had been done. But they've tended to be efforts to crack down, you know, and
right.
Assuming these are driven by Stephen Miller, tightening the processes, dragging out, slowing down applications. They've cut the number of refugees dramatically, which is completely under the president's authority to do,
right.
But I think wrongheaded, where a good number of refugees for the U.S. to admit has been 100,000 a year.
Right.
And I think the number is significantly lower. It's capped even, but I hesitate to say if it was 30,000, I think, but the actual number that will come in will be significantly lower. Totally unnecessary. I don't think made America any safer. And certainly hurt a lot of people that are desperate. But what he could do, I think, that would be very smart is to realize Congress, the legislative branch, has power over immigration. They don't have power over visitors. And I pointed out, we've got 181 million visitors.
Mm-hmm.
He could reach out and make some treaty or agreement structures with some of these other countries for people from those countries, foreigners, to come to America to study and work. And that really is an interesting area that I don't think has been taken advantage of. We have a visa waiver program. You may have heard of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's 32 countries around the world. Their citizens don't need a visa to come to the U.S. We don't have one with Mexico. We do have one, I think it's with Chile. Why? That would really just make all this go away. Yeah, you can come into the U.S. You can stay for 2 or 3 months, go back home.
Right.
Easy. You don't get to be a citizen. You don't get to vote. You don't get welfare. But we allow easy transit. We do it with Canada, for goodness sakes. We do it with Britain, Japan. Like I said, 32 countries. That's something the president could do that would diffuse the crisis such as it is.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. We've had 2 or 3 conversations on this podcast about immigration reform, and we kind of keep coming back to the same question, which is, when, if ever, will this get done? So Are we going to be very old men talking about this, Tim, or is there any possibility, at least in the lifetime of the Trump presidency, to see movement on this?
I think the president is – when Steve Bannon left, I remember thinking this is going to change because I thought Bannon was a bad actor. The second Trump presidency will have a fresh set of faces most likely. Heck, 2020 White House may have a fresh set of faces. So, yeah, I think there's an opportunity there. His chief of staff, Kelly, was very involved in this, former head of the DHS, had his preset views of the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think the ascendance of Mike Pompeo is being even more important to this White House and to this president. Secretary of State Pompeo could reshape this. And I think already, if again, speculation, mm-hmm. I think Stephen Miller's influence in this has peaked and may be waning. There could be a lot of excitement. With the Democrat, you could, looking at that field, I think 2/3 of them get elected, they're not going to make things any better. They're just going to be extreme in the left direction, and mm-hmm. you're going to get a lot of resistance. And you may see a replay of what happened in Europe, where the like Merkel tried to say, oh, we're open to all the immigrants who want to get here. Well, not only did they cause a backlash in Germany against that, but it caused a backlash in all the transit countries, Hungary and Greece.
Mm-hmm.
So you see a lot of wall building in Europe right now. And it is effective at stopping that because it's very expensive. And you're talking about populations that don't assimilate. Like Mexicans are Catholic, generally have deep roots in this country with Mexican-American communities. The flood of Syrians into Europe, though, is a totally different matter, and it's been a big-time assimilation problem there. Long-term, hopefully it all works out. But I think a hard-left president here is going to create an immigrant backlash that probably isn't good. I'd rather see one of the candidates, and I'm going to say like Joe Biden. I think Joe Biden would be really great at finding compromise on this issue, but who knows?
Yeah, that is my final question, Tim. Let's map out a scenario in which A, Trump is reelected, and B, the Congress goes entirely Democratic, and also a scenario in which the White House goes Democratic and the Congress goes Democratic.
Hmm.
Tell me a bit, just what is your hunch as to what, dealing with the Republican president, what would Democrats want on theirs? Would they offer the same thing to Trump as they would do with the Democratic president, or how would that play out?
Well, I don't think much changes, just because I don't want to say I'm cynical, but I've been in D.C. long enough, and I've seen this, you know, broken record keep getting played. The political consultants still think immigration is an issue that they can help, that will help their candidate. Whether their candidate is right or left, not solving this issue is, you know, it's a perennial employer for the consultant class. So mm-hmm. I don't think things change unless you get leadership that says they want it to change. And maybe that's Pelosi. She's shown more willingness to compromise than a lot of other folks in that party. But on this issue, when she called the wall immoral, I think that may have put a stake through the heart this year. It's up to the president now to offer the compromise.
Right. So what you're telling me is that as the Hoover Institution's fellow in immigration studies, you're sort of like the NFL's deputy commissioner on refereeing integrity.
Never goes away.
You have a job. It's not going to be solved anytime soon.
I'm just trying not to be Charlie Brown with the football. That's all. I just don't want to keep, you know. So, yeah, I'll swing at the football when it's not Lucy holding it. How about that?
Okay. Tim Kaine, enjoy the conversation.
You bet. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy choices confronting America's 45th president. You can find the Hoover Institution online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, I encourage you to sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which sends the best work of Hoover Fellows, including Tim Kaine, straight to your inbox. You can also find the Hoover Institution on Facebook and on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Tim Kaine is on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @TimmerKaine. That's @TimmerKaine, TimmerKaine. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Till then, thanks for listening. Take care.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on all major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, Podbean, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Spotify. I'm Chris Dower for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.